morning, and welcome back to Midpoint on WMNF Community Radio. We're broadcasting live from our studios in Tampa on March 25th, 2026. And my name is Gary Gibbons. I'm guest hosting today for Shelley Reback, who's enjoying a much-deserved break. Yesterday was a special election day in Florida, and there were three races held to fill vacant seats in the Florida legislature. I want to extend my huge congratulations to Brian Nathan, who was elected to the state Senate in District 14. And Brian defeated Josie Tomko, who has lived in and represented a district in the Florida House that's in Polk County, and many people felt like she was trying to move here solely to win this seat. She spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in the race, outspending Brian 15-1 and lost by 408 votes. A good reminder that every vote counts. Democrat Emily Gregory also flipped the House seat in Florida House District 87 down in Palm Beach, which includes Mar-a-Lago. An 11-point swing in that district that Trump won by more than 10 points back in 2024. And Republican Hillary Holley defeated Democrat Edwin Perez in the Polk County seat that Josie Tomko held and resigned from to run for the Tampa seat. So now that we have all of our legislative seats filled again, it's time for our legislature to get back to work because, unfortunately, they didn't do the one thing that they're supposed to do each year, which is to pass a budget. Actually, the legislature has two duties. The first is to pass a budget, which they failed to do during the regular session in the last two seasons. But the second duty is that they have to fully fund public education, which in my view, they failed to do every year for the past 25 or 30 years. Florida consistently ranks near the bottom of all states in per-student spending, somewhere between 42nd and 45th, depending upon which source you use, and we rank 49th in teacher salaries. So thank God for Mississippi, huh? The Florida Constitution says it's a paramount duty of the state to provide high-quality, free public education for all children, and the state must provide sufficient funds for a, quote, uniform, efficient, safe, secure, and high-quality system. So we know what they didn't do this year. Now let's hear about some of the bills that actually got passed. So first, joining me via Zoom is Cheyenne Drews, the Deputy Communications Director for Progress Florida, who also heads up the Floridians for Reproductive Freedom Coalition. Thank you for joining us today, Cheyenne.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. And also joining me in the studio is Representative Lindsey Cross, who represents parts of St. Petersburg and Pinellas Park in District 60. Welcome, Lindsey.
Good morning, Gary.
So glad you could be here. You know, when the session started, I know the outcry from most people and most Floridians were that they were struggling with the affordability issue. And, I'd like you to describe this year's session in terms of what you think got accomplished and what should have gotten accomplished,
yeah.
Perhaps.
Great question, Gary, and great to have you on also, Cheyenne. So this year, affordability clearly was the top of the list of the things that Floridians care about and were asking us to make some reforms to help them out. And we accomplished nothing on that front. We also know that affordability right now is even more difficult with rising gas prices as a result of this war in Iran, which doesn't have an end date right now. But at the state level, we, you know, miserably failed to bring reform to property insurance, which is one of the biggest costs that working families have to endure, whether you are a homeowner or a renter and are paying that through your, you know, increases in rent. We had 237 bills that ultimately passed both chambers and could potentially become law and I can't think of a single one of them that addressed affordability. That's despite the fact that there were many Democratic-led bills looking specifically at affordability. The Democratic caucus, both on the House and the Senate side, had a suite of bills focused on property insurance, on affordability issues, and those reforms would have gone a long way to help Floridians. And not surprisingly, not a single one of those bills got even a single committee hearing. And so there's so many good ideas that we're bringing to the table that never see the light of day, and Floridians are the ones that ultimately suffer.
What a shame, you know, not to even get a committee hearing on any of these bills is just shameful.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Cheyenne, I want to start off with you. Let's talk about one of the worst bills, House Bill 1471, that gives the governor and cabinet power to designate advocacy groups as, quote, domestic terrorist organizations, close quote. Can you tell us about that one?
Absolutely. Representative Cross, pleasure to be back with you as well. This bill is probably one that received some of the most headlines this legislative session for good reason, because most of us at some point in our lives can remember speaking out about an issue that we cared about, something we felt was unjust. And the reality of American history is it's been shaped, our country has been shaped and improved over time because of moments like that. And this bill, House Bill 1471, that did pass both the House and the Senate, it allows for organizations to be designated as this, quote, domestic terrorist organization based on really vague language and descriptions. And so essentially, this is giving a lot of power to the governor, the cabinet, the attorney general to target organizations that they can deem as engaging in allegedly dangerous activities, essentially intended to coerce the public or influence government policy. And what it comes down to is it gives, you know, the Republican leadership right now more power to target people who are speaking out about disagreeing with them. This is an incredibly dangerous bill. It was one of the final hour bills going back and forth between chambers for good reason. And one piece that folks might not have heard about is there's actually a corresponding public records exemption. So the reason why an organization or group might receive this designation, which of course would have a sweeping impact on their ability to organize, to engage people in advocacy processes, that those reasons why they have that designation are actually kept private from the public. And so it's really questionable. It's dangerous for our democracy, and it is a clear power grab, unfortunately, from the governor.
Yeah, and the bill actually also punishes people who promote those types of organizations, correct?
That's exactly right. And if folks are a little confused of how this designation could be placed, what could fall under it? Is it your local advocacy org for voter rights, women's rights? That confusion's the point. The chilling effect is the point, so that people, like you mentioned, feel that hesitancy to get engaged at a time when people are actually building power, when people are saying, you know, our elected leaders in a lot of ways are not reflecting our needs. As Representative Cross already mentioned, they left the legislature without a budget. I don't know about folks, but my rent is due on the first either way. And the fact that instead they're suppressing the voices of Floridians is such a missed opportunity and a misguided priority that time was spent on.
Well, Lindsay, you voted no on this, thankfully. Tell us why.
Well, I think Cheyenne gave a great rundown of what the bill does and why it is so dangerous. I'll say that there's a theme when we have these bills that pass led by the Republican supermajority. They're often to take away rights from Floridians. And we hear a lot of the rhetoric about the free state of Florida. But time and time again, in every year, we're rolling back rights of Floridians, rights related to reproductive choice, the ability to organize, to vote. We know that we have secure and fair elections, but every year we're targeting those because of these boogeymen that are invented. Also, you see that the language is quite vague, and it gives a lot of power to the executive branch or to, you know, the judicial branch to interpret what this means. And we also see that the Democrats, particularly when we get on the House floor, will offer a lot of amendments to put guardrails on things and to say, okay, if we're going to make these sweeping changes, we at least need clarity on what this definition means or how this will impact some of the organizations that are doing work. And those amendments always fail along party lines, but it shows that the intent is not to provide clarity or to provide a better life for Floridians. It's really to suppress the freedoms that people have fought so hard for in this state.
Yeah, I mean, as a lawyer, I look at this and it's vague and too much discretion is given to certain people to decide what is and is not, you know, a terrorist organization, and then to provide criminal penalties and things on top of that. I just can't wait for this one to be challenged in court. So hopefully it will be. Let's talk about another really bad bill. This is the voter suppression bill. Cheyenne, you want to talk about House Bill 991?
Absolutely. And Gary, if I may, I think we're going to see a trend about the bill's role we'll discuss today of the trajectory of a bill, you know, under this administration, passing largely along party lines, limiting debate and public input, passing, and then ultimately being litigated and stopped in court because of the deep unconstitutionality of this legislation, which House Bill 991 falls into that category. So this bill requires Floridians who are registering to vote for the first time, updating their registration, if they're moving, that type of thing, or get flagged for some type of reason to prove their citizenship using documentation. And, you know, before we get too far into it, I want to be clear that there are no changes because of this bill to voter registration or IDs or even vote by mail for the 2026 midterm elections. That's really important that folks know. But this bill really mimics the federal attempt as well to purge voters from the rolls, to remove folks from participating in our democracy by creating these really, you know, onerous requirements for proving citizenship in which a really error-prone government database is going to be, verifying through. If folks have used any state website in Florida, think about if you've ever applied for unemployment for Florida, for example. We don't have a lot of faith in these systems, to be operational. And so it's really an attempt to create intentional red lines to stop folks from voting. And one group I really want to point out, too, is this bill also stops university students from using their student IDs as identification when they vote. And so that intention seems very clear to me.
Lindsay, once again, you voted no on this one. Thank you. But tell us why.
I did. This is not going to prevent non-citizens from voting. It's going to actually make it harder for citizens to vote. Some of the testimony that we heard both in committee and the state affairs and on the floor by one of my colleagues sharing the story of her grandmother and great aunt who were born in the Deep South during Jim Crow era. And these are African-American black women who were not issued birth certificates. And the process that one of my colleagues has gone through, Representative Ashley V. Gant, to try to procure the type of documentation that her family members would need under a bill like this to be able to vote is nearly impossible. When these birth certificates were not issued, how do you replicate that for someone who's in their 70s, 80s, 90s, but has been a consistent voter, and this is very important to them? Those are the type of people that are going to be disenfranchised. We know from supervisors of election offices that are working really hard to have fair and secure elections. This is another hurdle that they're going to have to jump through. I want to point out something else that was very concerning is that it gives outside organizations that are unverified or potentially have partisan leanings the ability to suggest that someone is not a citizen. I actually offered an amendment on the House floor that would require that only government agencies could make those allegations, not a partisan group who really is looking to influence elections by removing people from the voter rolls. And of course, that amendment was not added to the bill, was shot down by the Republican supermajority, which again shows that it's not about maintaining the integrity of elections. It's really culling people from the voter rolls that people in power don't want to be voting.
Well, by way of a real life example, my mother, who will turn 101 years old on June 1st, will not be able to vote after January 1st because she stopped driving several years ago. She doesn't have a current driver's license or doesn't need a state ID. She has an unexpired passport, doesn't have an unexpired passport. She had a passport, but she doesn't travel anymore, so she doesn't need a new passport. Her birth certificate contains her maiden name and not her married name, which she changed when she married my father. And she has voted in every election since I was a child, but she's being disenfranchised now as a result of this bill. So if you're just joining us this morning, my name's Gary Gibbons, and my guests today are Cheyenne Drews of Progress Florida, who also heads up the Floridians for Reproductive Freedom Coalition, and District 60 Florida House Representative Lindsey Cross, who represents folks in Pinellas County. You can join the conversation by calling us at 813-239-9663 or by emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. or by sending a text message to 813-433-0885. Next bill that I want to talk about is, this one actually passed unanimously by both houses, and it's House Bill 697, which temporarily blocks proposed cuts by the DeSantis administration to a program that helps people afford very expensive life-saving AIDS and HIV medication. Cheyenne, can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So important to highlight this one. So this spring, the Florida Department of Health reduced essentially the income eligibility and eliminated the premium assistance and coverage for the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, shorthand is ADAP. And the Department of Health blamed budget shortfalls, which if we want to unpack Department of Health, you know, budget waste, fraud and abuse, happy to do that. And what it did is it essentially left 12,000 Floridians unable to access affordable HIV and AIDS medication. In the year 2026, Florida stopped allotting money for people to afford life-saving care. And this bill was a result of that. This essentially is going to be gap funding to ensure that until the next fiscal year begins, Florida's fiscal year begins on July 1st, that funds are allocated so folks can actually get this medication. And this was led by longtime advocate Senator Carlos Guillermo Smith, along with Senator Alexis Calatayud and Representative Jennifer Kincart Johnson, and was really, really a result of advocates, of folks like Michael Rayner of AIDS Health Foundation, Equality Florida, PRISM, and others, saying this has to happen. We have to ensure that funds are allocated before we even, if the budget isn't going to be put together by the end of this legislative session, this can't afford to wait. And so I am really relieved to see that the governor did sign this bill yesterday. So 12,000 Floridians are not having to live in that place of uncertainty that happened, you know, frankly, as a result of, misaligned priorities by our state in terms of where we're, you know, putting our money. And this life-saving care was absolutely worth the fight. And we still have to continue to urge lawmakers as they work on the budget to create a long-term solution so that folks never have to wake up wondering where they're going to get this medication.
Yeah, it's life-saving. You know, it's pretty simple. And these drugs are extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. So thank you for voting yes on that one.
Yeah, that was actually one of the proud moments that we had this session, and I appreciate that the governor did sign that and will give people some temporary relief. Clearly, it is something that we need to address in the final budget. And also wanted to give a shout out to my colleague on the House Democratic side, Representative Mitch Rosenwald, who also played a key role in making sure that we get this stopgap funding.
Fantastic. So there were a lot of problems with building permits following the back-to-back hurricanes that hit our area in 2024. And Lindsay, let's talk about House Bill 803 that talks about building inspections, building permits, and the language that you were successful in getting inserted into that bill that ultimately passed.
Yeah, so this bill was sponsored by Representative Tribolsi and Overdorf and then Senator DeSigley. And this was a large bill. I think it was around 60 pages about building inspections and permits. But what I'm proud of on this bill that passed the House and the Senate unanimously is we were able to include a provision in there that started out as a standalone bill, HB 1109 and SB 1260, that I worked on cooperatively with Senator DeSigley. We both represent a lot of the neighborhoods like Shore Acres and Riviera Bay that were hardest hit by Hurricanes Helene and Milton. And over the past two legislative sessions, the two of us have worked cooperatively on a lot of reforms to emergency management preparation and response. We got a lot of good policies into a large emergencies bill last year, SB 180. And this language specifically will add the ability for local governments to procure, to tap into and get more permitting staff, building inspectors, and plans reviewers following natural disasters, because we know that there continues to be a backlog at these local governments who were, you know, we're not prepared for the number of rebuilding permits that we've seen. So this looks at developing state term contracts with private inspectors and also using something called mutual aid agreements with other states. This is something we do after disasters quite frequently for other services like debris removal or fire and, you know, search and rescue, but we've never explored it for building permits before. And so I worked really cooperatively with the Division of Emergency Management, with the Division of Business and Professional Regulations, as well as my cities and counties to look at the right language to make sure that there are guardrails if we're going to bring in qualified and licensed inspectors from other states on a temporary basis. They would have to work under the direction of the permitting staff, the existing staff, and could do it for a one-year period. But I think it's going to bring a lot of relief to our cities and counties, knowing that there are now two new mechanisms that they can tap into to get staff to help people to rebuild faster, to get back into their homes, to get back to their lives and provide them some sense of normalcy.
Yeah, I think we all know somebody who had a flooding incident or some sort of damage from those hurricanes that have stories about how long it took to get a permit and how they were just, you know, unable to get anything started to rebuild their home. So mm-hmm. Thank you for that great work.
You're welcome.
There's another culture war bill that forbids local governments from supporting diversity programs. And guess what? It enables the governor to suspend local elected officials who violate the prohibition. Cheyenne, you want to talk about Senate Bill 1134? It seems like suspending local elected officials is one of the governor's favorite pastimes.
Absolutely. You know, when you can't win with the rules, you break them, right? And I wish we could spend more time on bills like the one Representative Cross just mentioned that actually reflect the needs that constituents, I'm sure, brought to her that said, you know, I'm experiencing this disaster and I need help, or I don't even need help, I need government to get out of the way, or whatever the good governance reaction that craft bills like the one that she just went over. This bill is not that. This bill is absolutely, as you mentioned, not only a culture war, but also a distraction from everything that was not going to get accomplished this legislative session. It faced bipartisan opposition from local elected officials, from lawmakers, from the public. And you know, frankly, through the process, it was a mess. It required multiple amendments to address different carve-outs of, quote, unintended consequences from bill sponsors, that this bill would essentially prohibit local governments from, you know, for example, hosting Black History Month celebrations and Pride celebrations. Multiple carve-outs were accomplished to sort of reduce the harm of this legislation. But it's a testimony to what happens when policy is crafted not with directly impacted people, but with a political agenda in mind. And so, as I mentioned, a number of protections were added to the bill. I'm a proud resident of Orlando. I live just minutes from the Pulse nightclub. And because of extreme advocacy, you know, protections, for example, honoring the Pulse Memorial in Orlando were added. But the fact that that wasn't considered from the get-go is just really ignorant to the diverse, you know, identities and needs of Floridians across our state. And also just say too that oftentimes our local governments and communities are holding the line against some of those really big overarching attacks from the governor, from the state, and also provide these incredible opportunities for representation, for an honoring of our history, and to just chart a better course for our state at the neighborhood level. So this was a clear attempt to take away that local control, it is so unfortunate that so much time was spent on a bill like this when we had real problems to address, like Representative Cross mentioned.
You want to talk about this one, Lindsay?
Yeah, absolutely. And great explanation from Cheyenne. You know, this is not just about stifling free speech and trying to stamp down on diverse populations, but it's also going to hurt our economies in these local areas. St. Pete Pride, which has been a month-long celebration, we actually have a winter pride now. I think the numbers from last year were that it brought, you know, it had an economic impact of over $60 million in our state. And it is, I think we use the word pride, it's become a source of pride in our city, where you see there's family-friendly days, there's opportunities for neighbors to get together. When I march in the parade, I often see the flags from the homeowners.
Our neighborhood.
In our neighborhood.
40 people that went down.
Yep.
So it was
and
great.
I'm waving to you all. And these are the type of things that, you know, they're intending to stifle and to get rid of. But these are incredibly important for the economy of these local communities, for small businesses. You know, I think of these type of events kind of like our Black Friday, where these community events bring people not just from the region, but outside of the state to come and spend money to, you know, stay in our hotels, eat in our restaurants, support our tourism-based economy. And this is going to have a real chilling effect on this. And we're going to see fewer of these type of events and less participation at the local level because of it. And it's really sad, because our state thrives on its diversity, not by silencing diverse voices.
Okay, we are going to take a short break for a message, and we will be back to actually talk about a good bill. How about that?
This Saturday on WMNF's HD3 channel, The Source will bring you a special program from the Pacifica Radio Network. You'll hear voices of journalists from independent stations across the country reporting from the No Kings demonstrations. Coverage begins at noon and goes until 8 in the evening. There are several ways you can listen to WMNF's HD3, The Source. You can listen on an HD radio, or on WMNF.org, or on the WMNF app. That's Pacifica's live coverage of the No Kings demonstrations this Saturday from noon until 8 on The Source, WMNF's all-news HD3 station.
Welcome back to Midpoint. My name's Gary Gibbons, and my guests today are Cheyenne Drews of Progress Florida, who also heads up the Floridians for Reproductive Freedom Coalition, and District 60 Florida House Representative Lindsay Cross, who represents folks in Pinellas County, like me.
Mm-hmm.
She's my rep, and I'm happy that she's my rep. All right, let's talk about it. Good bill that passed and actually got signed by the governor. Lindsay, tell us about Senate Bill 302 that involved that proposed horrible cruise port idea that was going to be built at the southern end of the Sunshine Skyway Bridge in the Terracea Aquatic Preserve.
Yeah, so Senate Bill 302 is a coastal resiliency bill, and this is one that's been in the works for several years. The House sponsor of it, Representative Jim Mooney from the Florida Keys, has been working so hard on this language, and I want to commend him for his, you know, just sticking with this and getting a great bill across the finish line that, first of all, recognizes the importance of green infrastructure, of things like living shorelines, of planting mangroves and seagrasses to help improve coastal resiliency. The part that's getting the most attention now is this provision that was added to try to provide more protections for this property. It's about 328 acres, the Terracea Aquatic Preserve. This is at the mouth of Tampa Bay, Manatee County area, just south of the Skyway, the Sunshine Skyway. And this is one of the most pristine, cleanest water that we have in the Tampa Bay area, in the Gulf. And there has been an attempt to put a massive cruise ship terminal here. We know that the cruise ships keep getting bigger and bigger. And even with the Sunshine Skyway, there's been thought that it's not going to be tall enough to accommodate some of these massive, massive cruise ships. And so this idea of putting a new cruise terminal in one of the most ecologically sensitive and also one of the most ecologically important areas in the Tampa Bay region is just faced incredible backlash, not just from residents and businesses, but also from elected officials.
Fishing guides,
absolutely. But, you know, this policy was added when the bills were going to the Senate and the House floor to provide some protections. And I think we need to all stay vigilant and make sure that this is adequate and continue the advocacy to prevent this and ensure that this really critical natural area stays natural and protected.
Yeah, the average depth in that area is anywhere from 2 feet to 5 feet deep, you know, and depending upon what the tides are. And Rattlesnake Key is mm-hmm. a very popular place to fish. And what they would have to do to create a cruise port there would be to dredge out to about 50 feet deep, would just destroy that entire ecosystem. And that to me was the best thing that actually came out of the legislature this year. So very, very proud that y'all got that done. Cheyenne, your group focuses on reproductive freedom, and I know you do a lot of work in that area. And because it's International Women's Month still, I want to talk about that. And I really want to talk about some of the reproductive rights bills that got proposed that were pretty horrible, but that failed. Can you talk about some of those?
Absolutely. I sit on the steering committee, as you mentioned, for the Floridians for Reproductive Freedom Coalition, which is one of the nation's largest state-based grassroots coalitions committed to the full spectrum of reproductive health and justice. And for the second year in a row, we were able to successfully stop the overwhelming majority of bills that were targeting reproductive freedom. The same thing goes for LGBTQ plus rights. I hope this, indicates a trend away from these culture wars. While this was historically unproductive as a legislative session, we also dodged a lot of bullets. And, you know, to think through some of the main bills that were, attempted to further restrict reproductive freedom in Florida, you know, this year we saw a $100,000 bounty bill filed. This bill is absolutely horrifying. It's modeled after Texas. It essentially, this is House Bill 663, would have created a cause of action for the husband, brother, abuser, or even a rapist of a patient to sue for $100,000 in damages if a patient accessed abortion pills by mail or through telehealth. They wouldn't have even had to have utilized the pills. This bill did not get a single hearing, but the fact that it even was filed in Florida is a deeply dangerous indication of some of the priorities parties that still remain, among the most extreme legislators in our state. Another bill that now for the third year in a row has been stopped by Senator Aaron Grawl. We've dubbed the Abusers Bill of Rights, Senate Bill 164, is one of the slipperiest slopes that Florida could go down. Essentially, this bill is an attempt to ultimately give fertilized eggs and embryos the same rights as you and I. And so what that actually looks like in practice is it would mean that if a pregnant patient was needing healthcare, whether that healthcare was abortion care, whether it was IVF, chemotherapy, even emergency care, it would be lawyers, not doctors, that would be consulted as to whether or not they could get that care, even in an emergency. And so, like I mentioned, this bill was stopped for a third year in a row. But this trend towards, reducing our rights for the sake of this political agenda, for this extremism, is so dangerous. And it's playing out. These consequences are playing out not only in other states, but starting to happen here in Florida. And so a number of other bills targeted reproductive freedom, including attempts to ultimately decimate IVF and surrogacy, as well as really restrict access for minors to access even mental health resources like a suicide prevention hotline. And so I'm really, really proud to say that these bills were stopped. We have to remain vigilant, as it's very likely that they'll return next year. But right now I'm sitting really grateful for the partners that engaged around this, for legislators that put up a lot of fights so that hopefully most Floridians won't even ever have to know about these bills that would have made their lives a lot more dangerous.
Yes, thank you for that. We do have a caller, Steve from Largo. Steve, are you there?
Yes, thank you for a fantastic show, great journalism, great public radio. I had called originally because you were on the marine ecology Gulf of Mexico topic, and I'll briefly mention that. But regarding women's rights in Florida, what I refer to the MAGA legislature who propose these types of oppressive things, they're promoting gestation slavery. It's hard enough that nature has given women the vast majority of the reproductive burden for our species. These people are showing worse than misogyny and sexism. And just like the orange pedo in the White House, the fact that they want to protect the rights of rapists and abusers is quite troubling. And in Texas, they even give rapists parental rights in some cases. It's disgusting. The other statement I would say regarding legislation about the Gulf of Mexico and enforcement of existing legislation, as someone born and raised in Pinellas and an ocean swimmer for 60 years, I can tell you there is no protection. The Gulf of Mexico off Pinellas is ecologically dead. That's not a matter of opinion. When I was a child in the 60s, there was hundreds of dolphins and manatees near shore, millions of shells, tens of thousands of birds, millions of fish. It's all gone. It's all gone because of policies, population growth, climate change. Nobody's doing anything about it. And I'll leave you with this. As a non-motorized user of the Gulf of Mexico, along with kayakers, et cetera, there is no mandated protection for me. Motorized watercraft do endanger me on a regular basis, and no one will do anything about it.
Thank you, Steve, for your comments. All right. I don't know if I know there's a swimming zone, at least off of Anna Maria, they have some buoys, but they are hundreds of yards apart, and, mm-hmm. and probably, it's up to the boaters to recognize what that is. And sadly, there's not a lot of boating education before people go out and start operating their vessels. I want to talk about selling off state lands to agriculture. Senate Bill 290. Lindsay, can you talk about that one?
Sure. So this bill, along with another bill called, I think it was called cattle grazing. This is a theme that we saw this session about opening up conservation lands for cattle grazing. And the people who are in support of this, they'll talk about how expensive it is for new farmers and ranchers to get into the industry. And I certainly empathize with the idea that it's just becoming more and more expensive to live in Florida and for people to start businesses, including being in agriculture. And it's also critically important that we maintain agriculture for food security, for the benefits that it does provide, and keeping those lands from being developed for urban and suburban uses. But I think it is troubling that we're looking at our conservation lands that have already been purchased or protected with taxpayer dollars as one of the first places that they're looking. I was really grateful to be able to offer an amendment that passed to a cattle grazing bill that I worked on cooperatively with ranchers and the environmental community that put some significant guardrails on the ability to use public parks or state parks or forest for cattle grazing. It ensured that natural habitat, native habitat could not be converted to improve pasture, and that the ecological, the recreational aspects of those lands be foremost in consideration before deciding whether cattle grazing would be allowed. So the way I termed it is that not just can you do this, but should you do this? That bill ultimately did not pass on the Senate side, but the provision within the larger agriculture bill to open up some of these conservation lands did pass. I think it's important that Floridians have the assurance that when lands are protected, that they will be protected for future generations. And I think it's dangerous that we're starting to get away from that, as well as some of the initial budgets that we've seen have shifted money very significantly from a program called Florida Forever, which has been kind of our premier conservation program for water and land for many decades in the state. This provides the opportunity for the state to either buy the land outright, which is something called fee simple, or to put an easement on that land, so to protect it in the future, but still allow some other uses, which often are ranching, timber operations, things within agriculture. But what we've seen is an incredible shift from that program over to something called the Rural and Family Lands Protection Program through the Department of Agriculture. And the primary goal of that program is to maintain working landscapes like cattle ranches. And then ecological and wildlife values are also considerations, but they're not the primary goal. And so in the House budget right now, as it stands, there was no money allocated for Florida Forever, and $500 million, half a billion dollars for the Rural and Family Lands Program. And so we're seeing this imbalance in how these programs are recognized through funding and policies. And I would argue that we need both of those programs as our state continues to grow with full-time residents and with tourists. We need to increase opportunities for public access, and a state park is very different than a cattle ranch that has a conservation easement over it, because the public doesn't have the ability to go on those private lands with easements on them the way they are able to go to a state park or a park that's protected through community or county or city resources. So we need to address the full suite of those needs and not put so much emphasis on the agricultural component that we're losing out on some of the benefits of our conservation lands and the critical access that we provide to the public.
Yeah, I think it's a real slippery slope when you start changing the ownership of land, as you said, from being owned by the state to being then transferred fee simple title to a agricultural company. One question I have is, how long do they have to use it in agricultural purposes before they decide that for whatever reason, as you see everywhere, think for example the orange groves, you know, that were everywhere when I was a kid, they're all gone now. Mm-hmm. And they've all turned into subdivisions. What's to stop that company from saying, well, I tried to farm, but we had a hurricane and it wiped out my property, so I want to Can I sell it?
Yeah, can I cash out?
Yeah, exactly. So very, very scary, and we do need to preserve these things that are so critical for our ecological balance. Let's see what else we've got. We've got so many bills.
So many.
Only
237 that passed, though.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the ones that didn't pass that you're...
Well, there's, you know, every time you turn around, there's some other preemption by the state of some local government function, and that's a problem. But one of the ones that I did think was a good bill that got a lot of support from both sides of the aisle was the one that I guess was a reaction to the governor trying to do land swaps in secret. House Bill 441, which requires state officials to provide more public notice and detailed justifications for proposed sales or swaps of state conservation lands. And that passed 109-0 in the House and 37-0 in the Senate. Tell me about that one.
Well, this is a kind of a continuation of us having to play defense in attempts to privatize our state lands again. You know, last year we saw it with our state parks where there were the proposals to put golf courses and pickleball and large lodging operations more in line with a hotel than a, you know, a rustic cabin in our state parks. And of course, people were going to have none of that. And we were able to pass a bill to provide more protections for our state parks. And then just on the tail end of that was a land swap over in Northeast Florida in the Guana Preserve area. And so that was something that was happening very quickly with very little public notice. And it's so critical that anything that we do as a government, that the public has the opportunity to be made aware of it, to share their concerns or their suggestions. And anytime we're limiting people's opportunities to be involved in the democratic process, I think is very concerning. So this bill will provide some, you know, longer timeframes for notices if there are going to be land swaps and hopefully prevent things that have happened in the past, but I'd like us to work more towards proactive policies, things like the Coastal Resiliency Bill, you know, the inclusion of the language to try to stop that new cruise port terminal is important, but if we had better guardrails, better policies in place, we wouldn't have companies trying to privatize and make money off of our public resources. I'd rather see better protections up front rather than having to come back each year and make changes to fix some of the wrongs that have been highlighted through loose policies.
And I see that the war on climate continues in Tallahassee. House Bill 1217, again, another preemption bill, strips local governments of the power to enact policies intended to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and combat climate change. And, St. Petersburg, several years ago, adopted a Sierra Club policy, which was called Ready for 100, and it was trying to get local governments to focus on becoming 100% reliable upon renewable energy and not fossil fuels. We've seen the problems in the Persian Gulf that caused by availability of fossil fuels. And yet, once again, Tallahassee is tamping down the ability of a local government to even try to do anything to preserve the quality of the air in their local city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one that I spoke out and debated on the House floor. And again, very concerning. I feel like we're going in the wrong direction in many ways as a state. We know that we are one of the most vulnerable states to climate change, to sea level rise, to storms and hurricanes. And just because we had an easy hurricane season last year doesn't mean that we will be so lucky in the future. One of the ways that we help to protect ourselves is to shift away from dirty fossil fuels and using more renewable sources. But there's big money in coal and natural gas and these investor-owned utilities that provide significant contributions and help to direct a lot of these bad policies. I think it's critical that our local governments continue to be proactive, because they're the ones that are on the front line when a home is flooding and we're dealing with the recovery after a storm. It's our local governments that are the first to respond, who are knocking on doors and asking residents what they need. It's the state and the federal governments come in later, but our local governments should be taking the lead and shifting to cleaner renewable energy sources. And again, this is just another policy to take power away from the local governments that are responding to what their residents and businesses want and centralize all this power up in the state government.
So you've got a couple of special sessions coming up from what I hear. One is to actually get the budget done before the end of June, right? Mm-hmm. And then what else have you heard might be in the offing for you?
Yeah, so there's potentially several special sessions that will be called for. We know that sometime in mid-April, an undisclosed date, we should be coming back up to finalize the budget. This is our only constitutional duty this year, and we have failed to do that during the 60-day legislative session again. The governor has already called for a special session the week of April 20th to look at congressional redistricting, which is unconstitutional. Yep. We've seen this happen in other states, and it's really a response from Republicans at the national level, the Trump administration, who knows that their policies are deeply unpopular. Again, life is less affordable than it was when Trump was elected in November. And I think there's a lot of concern from Republicans that they're going to lose some congressional seats if they don't change the rules and fight unfairly. So congressional redistricting is on the table, and I have deep concerns about doing that. There's also the potential that we'll come back up and look at property taxes and a joint resolution to put something on the amendment. Again, there are serious repercussions of rolling back and, you know, or complete elimination of property taxes and how it's going to lead to less safe communities and really a
we'll do another
reduction.
Whole show on all yeah. of that, because it's
Gosh.
Really, really
it's,
bad.
Yeah, it's something that you could barely even get into in a full hour.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. I want to thank my guest today, Cheyenne Drews from Progress Florida. Cheyenne, can you tell folks how they can find out more about Progress Florida and the Floridians for Reproductive Freedom Coalition?
Absolutely. We're on social media, website as well, progressflorida.org. And, you know, I want to remind folks that we don't have to passively track legislation or the process. We can be active participants. We're experts in our own fields and our own lived experiences and can help inform the process and policies that legislators work on. They're elected to represent us. And as we go to bed, I know that most Floridians are not thinking about things like book bans or rainbow crosswalks. They're thinking about the cost of childcare and raising rents and property insurance. And so we just really encourage you to find the organizations, find the pathways that make sense to you to engage with your legislators on the state and local level. We'd love to have you a part of that on our work. And if you're concerned about the, you know, increasing restrictions, particularly on reproductive freedom as well, please head to floridareprofreedom.com and get engaged. It doesn't have to stay like this in Florida. We absolutely need to get politicians out of these deeply personal and private decisions.
Okay, that's going to do it for us. We're going to have to wrap it here. We are WMNF Tampa, and stay tuned for Talking Animals. Duncan Strauss has Kevin Nealon as his guest, so that should be a great show. WMNF Tampa.